You're listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental.
TMZ, oh my goodness.
I think he's the philosopher of football.
I'd like to have some more derbies.
Absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Welcome to Extra Time, driven by Continental from the AT&T MLS Studios in New York. We are back. I am David Goss with Matt Doyle. Bobby Warshaw held down the fort last Thursday. We thank all of you for being so kind to listen to that. Such a good young man Bobby is. But now you guys are back and you get to have the actual show you enjoy. It's not just charity for Bobby.
Tell us about your voice. Because usually you have this mellifluous?
Not a real
David Goss.
Yes. Yeah, this beautiful.
I don't think anyone's
tenor.
Ever said that.
Yeah.
But maybe.
But it's a little hoarse. You got some.
Got some tea?
Yeah.
Well, it's fall, and I have some honey in my tea because that's a great thing to do in the fall. Mm-hmm. Also, Andrew Reeby got married last week. It's been a really long celebration of Andrew's love.
He didn't have a wedding day. He had a wedding week.
I don't know what he did. I know what I did for the week.
Do you?
That's her. He cried a lot.
Did he?
Andrew Reeby, big time tear guy. Yeah.
Did you?
No.
No.
I felt bad about that for a moment.
More importantly, did Megan?
No.
Okay.
All right.
When Cam came down the aisle, everyone, Cam wearing just the vest, looked like John Travolta. I was like, I might cry because that kid's cute. But that was the only moment.
All right.
Andrew's love doesn't move me. I just want that to be put out there. It was a great time. He will be back on Thursday. I think he'll be back on Club and Country on Tuesday night after the USA-Canada game, which would be a really good transition if that's where I was going at this exact moment. But you're about to pull me back.
I am. So were there wagers placed amongst?
There was wagers placed.
There
was a cry mark.
Okay.
5.5.
Okay.
Over under.
Yeah.
I went under.
Okay.
I had a little confidence that over the course of a ceremony and event, like, it would space out. I'd say Mindy came down the aisle. He was already at 3 to 3.5. It was bad. So I lost that one.
You lost that one.
So I went double or nothing on the Michael Bradley reference in his vows. Like, I'll be the number 6 of your life. I can hit that long, you know, diagonal for you every time you need it. Didn't get that. So it was a little
let
down. Yeah. We got a I Believe chant in there because he's from KC. And we just sang the RSL Riot song consistently.
I would hope so. Yeah.
As naturally one does.
Yeah, rivals.
You're both wearing cobalt now.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
So now we're back.
Were there wagers placed on who's next?
No. I've had my money on Ben Bear for 2 years now.
Yeah, that seems right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
yeah. All right.
Bobby, do you want to get in on this?
We had a conversation while you guys were gone about how much we dislike when the podcasts we enjoy listening to open with a thing that they're not supposed to be talking about. Yeah. So Susanna did this thing where we just went straight into it.
Okay. So you're going to tell me that now when we're 3 minutes into the show.
I wasn't going to stop you anyway.
After Doyle's gone on his rant.
All I can do is sit back in my chair, not pay attention, and hope you guys go through as quickly as possible.
On that note, Andrew Reeby will be back on Extra Time Radio on Thursday. You can listen to that on all your podcast platforms, or you can watch it on YouTube. You can also see him on Club and Country Tuesday night on MLSsoccer.com and everything else because the U.S. is playing Canada in a CONCACAF Nations League A game. Had to make sure I got that right. Mm-hmm. It is probably the biggest game since World Cup qualifying ended for the U.S. outside of the Gold Cup final against Mexico.
Bigger than the Gold Cup final.
I just got upped on that one. Why do you say that?
Because the Gold Cup final at this point in the process was gravy on anything else, right? They weren't expected to win. If they had won, it would have been phenomenal. They made the game close enough that it felt like a step forward for Greg Berhalter. Everyone knows how far the U.S. men's national team is behind Mexico right now. So he didn't, barring a disaster, which you might be able to say we saw in MetLife a month later, but barring disaster in that Gold Cup final, everything he accomplished was a positive. In this game, they have nothing to gain. They have everything to lose against Canada. It's a much more pressure-filled game than the Gold Cup final for the U.S.
Interesting take, and I don't totally disagree with you. The U.S. beat Cuba 7-0 on Friday night. Weston McKinney had a hat trick. There's nothing else I care about in that game, so I'm ready to move on to Canada. Are you guys good?
I am going to recommend Bobby's column from that night, from the reaction. Yeah, I think you actually spell it out pretty well, Bobby, because the idea behind what Greg Berhalter is doing is positional play. Meaning that, like, everything that the U.S. does in building out from the back and even into the final third comes from patterns, comes from rehearsed patterns. Here's option A, here's option B, here's option C. If they take away option A, then you go to option B. If they take away option B, you go to option C. If they take away option C, it's back to A. Over and over and over again. And it takes a long time. You don't see a lot of it at the international level. It takes a long time to get up to speed on this. And I think the idea is, if you can do it against Cuba, which is like driving, it's learning to drive in a 25 mile per hour zone, right? Then the next step is you try to do that against 40, 45 miles an hour, which is, I think, what Canada is. Because Canada, they're not going to have the ball against the U.S. They can't press like Mexico, but they have attackers. They have this one thing that they do really, really well that can hurt you. So I thought it was like a very, very good test for the U.S. And to me, it showed a better indication that this team understands what Berhalter wants from them on an individual level, but also as a collective level. Because if you think back to that 6-0 win over Trinidad and Tobago in the Gold Cup, which was, I think, it was a big game given the crap around it. That was just the U.S. having better individual play.
All the goals came in transition. All the goals came from individual moments. They weren't replicable moments that Greg Berhalter would have discussed with his team.
So then, if it worked against Cuba, mm-hmm. and now the training wheels are slightly off, although I think Cuba's 2 to 5 miles per hour. But
that's fair. It might be a 10 mile an hour.
Yeah, every time a player defects, they go down 5 miles per hour. So it's been about 11 this year. Do you just run it back then against Canada in terms of lineup? In terms of the decisions he made, Jackson Ewell at center mid, Josh Sargent at center forward?
I would definitely go with Sargent at center forward. No questions asked. I would still probably start Michael Bradley over Jackson Ewell, even though I'm a huge Jackson Ewell fan, and he's been very good in 2 straight games now for the U.S. I still think Michael Bradley is just a better player. So I would start Bradley, but I would definitely start Pulisic at left wing. I wouldn't start him as the 10. I would consider going Sebastian Legette over Christian Roldan, but that actually brings up an interesting thing. Bobby, we've talked about this. The best thing about Weston McKennie's game, those late runs into the box. Absolutely the best thing about his game. And if he plays as the right side number 8, he doesn't get to make as many of those late, potentially goal-scoring runs as he does if he's the left-sided number 10.
Why does the side that he's on matter?
I just think the way it's played out recently, ever since Berhalter has kind of scrapped that inverted right back, the hybrid defensive midfielder right back position, the left-sided number 10 has gotten forward more often, both on and off the ball, than the right-sided number 8.
This is a little part of the natural, he plans out 98%. This part has come naturally, where that left-sided 10 gets into the box more than the right-sided 10.
Well, also, doesn't the left back not get as high as the right back, and that's part of it?
That certainly seems to, but is that planning or is that personnel? Because Daniel Lovitz is not as good going forward as Reggie Cannon. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, you want your left-sided 10 getting higher because you want to give someone who can combine with Pulisic, and Pulisic's been playing as a left winger more often. So I don't know whether this is natural, personnel-based, or something actually planned out.
Just to talk about it real quick, mm-hmm. With the outside backs getting high. I know you don't want to talk about big picture things.
No, it's
but
fine.
If we're going to talk about the inverted right back, remember the point of the inverted right back was because you had the wide right channel taken by a winger. You bring that player in because you want to help A, build possession, but B, protect against the counter. When you have both wingers wide, which we saw in the third and fourth goals, now all of a sudden your outside backs take the inner channel. So it's your two center backs, one defensive midfielder, two center backs, and then in front of them is one defensive midfielder and two outside backs tucked in slightly.
Which is also very Pep.
Almost everything at this point with these ideas is some deviance of what Pep did,
yep.
Right? The other variance of that is all of a sudden you put the outside backs high, you tuck the wingers in, so it's almost like three center strikers. This is where goals 1 and 2 came from, and you drop a defensive midfielder. So now all of a sudden it's a 2-2, 4-2, whatever you want to call it. So you still have players in those similar spots. It's just who is there depends on the rotation they happen to be in, or the quote-unquote set they happen to be in that moment.
I would actually go so far as to say that the base formation in possession that Berhalter is going for has changed from a 3-2-2-3 to a 2-3-2-3. I do think that, you know, he's kind of adjusted that, as Tyler Adams hasn't been available, and as certain things in terms of the personnel on the front line hasn't quite worked out.
So you talked about the attack for Canada. We'll do the Canada side after this because this is an even bigger game for them than it is for the U.S.
This is a huge game for them. Yeah. For our fans out there, Canada needs to win this game. Or I guess they could draw and then win next month, but they need 4 points from the two games against the U.S. to get into the hexagonal. Their chances of the hexagonal are like hanging by a thread here.
But they're better than they thought they'd be a month ago before
thanks
El Salvador lost the Dominican Republic. Shout out DR. So, Tim Ream, Matt Miazga, Daniel Lovitz, are these the names you think we're going to see roll out there on Tuesday?
I want to go back. We need to give more talk about Josh Sargent. That's what people want to talk about.
Yeah, 100%.
The question is, did Josh Sargent play ahead of Giassi Zardes because Giassi Zardes was getting rested for the Tuesday game, or because A, they want to get Josh Sargent reps with the first team, or B, give Josh Sargent a chance to win his spot? Because we've talked about this a million times, and all three of us, I think, disagree with this idea, but the general premise is Giassi plays because Giassi understands the movements and the rotations. In that case, Friday night's game was a chance for Josh Sargent to show that he could do that. Right, that he could take his heightened level of talent and pair it with his role in the system. Did he do that to you guys? Did he show that he understood his role and therefore locked down his place for Tuesday?
I think he's come a long way in the last two games compared to where he was against Jamaica, where he was lost against Jamaica in that pre-Gold Cup game. And I just think he's so much better individually than Giassi that it's worth it to me to...
The answer is yes. So, he did enough,
just walking on the field and not breaking his leg is enough for me in this situation. But like two of those McKennie goals could or maybe even should have been Sargent goals. Mm-hmm. He's like, and Berhalter talked about this after the game. Like Sargent needs to, his runs need to start a split second earlier. He needs to disguise them a little bit. If you watch the way he moves off the ball, like he's like an arrow. At times, and like there's no guile there, and that comes with time. So that actually argues for giving him another game to prove it against a better team. And like you said, this is a big game for the U.S. I don't think it's as big as what you said, but it's a big game. So I would hope that he's the starter.
I'm actually going to change this, and stop me if it's just a really bad question. It seems like Greg Berhalter is going to start Zardes. Is it just insane for him to do it at this point?
No, I don't think so. Because you have a conversation that you can have, and we've had this for a lot, but if your idea is to beat Canada on Tuesday night, I don't know that Josh Sargent is the best option, because when you look at Canada, they're so weak defensively that you will create chances.
The point is, if you can't beat Canada even with Josh Sargent instead, if Giassi Zardes compared to Josh Sargent is a person that makes a difference there, then you've got other problems. And at some point, is it the national team coach's duty? And I don't think we could have ever said this before in history, but with the way social media works, with the way 24-hour coverage and increasing coverage of American soccer in this country, is it worth it if you're the head coach to just make the decision that appeases the fans and makes your life a little bit easier on a marginal decision like this?
I think it's a red herring. I understand why you're asking the question, and my answer to that question is no. I think that Josh Sargent should start over Giassi Zardes on merit. He's just a better soccer player, and that 5% or 10% you lose in terms of understanding the system, you get back just on innate individual skill and talent. And that's like, if you're not going to get Josh Sargent the reps now, wait, we're going to wait another year and suddenly we're at World Cup qualifying and we're still starting?
Yeah, but he might be starting at center forward week in and week out in the Bundesliga and be making the runs that he needs to make. And he might be a better player at that point where it's okay to say tomorrow, Giassi Zardes, whatever it is he does, will make Pulisic's life easier than Josh Sargent's will.
I guess. I don't see that argument. I understand what you're saying. Yeah, so I would feel a lot more comfortable about everything if Josh Sargent started this game.
And we'll see what happens. And it goes down to how Berhalter is judging what his job is right now in terms of developing players for the future. For Canada...
Do you actually believe that Giassi Zardes gives the U.S. a better chance of winning this game than Josh Sargent?
I think it's a lower ceiling, higher floor.
Okay.
No, the floor
is low?
We've just seen it, man.
Yeah.
And this is, I hate that we do this to Jossie. I hate that he's in this position just because we don't have somebody better. It actually makes me sick that we have done this to Jossie Zardes for 18 months and he continues to be in this conversation. And I want nothing less than to move on from this conversation. I feel bad for bringing it up.
And just to contextualize
it. The floor has been low, man.
And just to contextualize it, in Jossie, when he has played center forward for the U.S. national team, which is, I think, 33 games now, he scores a goal about once every three games, which is roughly the same rate as Eddie Johnson. It's a higher rate than our good friend Charlie Davies did. It's a higher rate than Brian Ching did.
Are we taking out the El Salvador goals? Eddie Johnson would have banged home six on Cuba because that's what Eddie Johnson did. Let's be real about that. We're taking out those multi-goal performances against bad performance. But anyway, I get your point stands.
Because every new U.S. national team forward has those.
Right.
Sure. The point stands.
So look, Josh Sargent's just a better player right now, but like we shouldn't trash Jossie Zardes. Thank you for your service. I'm glad we have a backup, but like he should be the backup.
Okay, so let's move on to the other side for Canada. I've talked to a few Canadians today. They said that it's the biggest game since blank X blank in blank country in Central America.
Because
why have that bad conversation?
The game
today?
That's not even.
Let's talk about happy things. Let's enjoy this.
How were they eliminated from last time? Because that was two
same team, but
they lost to Honduras.
Scoreline.
Yeah. Was it 8-1?
No, 8-1 was the last one. 5-1 was the first one.
I don't remember.
Yeah. See, this is why we shouldn't do this.
Yeah.
I've been told, and it's been fueled into my veins, that this is a massive rivalry and that Canada wants to beat the U.S. so bad. People in my DMs, people adding me, people in the emails, in the mailbag. So I appreciate all of you for giving me that energy, giving me that juice. Now, John Herdman has to put his team out there and do it for Canada at home against the U.S. Big loss in Daniel Henry. We talked about it a little bit. He got a red card against Cuba, so he'll be suspended. So, Doyle, for Canada, you know there has to be at least one lineup change or one lineup decision for John Herdman. I think there's three or four big ones. What do you focus in on? What do you think are the biggest ones for him to make?
I mean, replacing Henry, who is their best center back, is a big one. I mean, Derek Cornelius is a young player who has young player issues in terms of his positioning. I think he can eventually become a good player, but he's not there yet. Steven Vitoria is an old player, and he's not the most mobile guy in the world. Kamal Miller, another young player who might play at center back. There's no real answer there. And then you look at right back, which is a position that cost them so much against Haiti in the Gold Cup. Well, Godinho's gone. They brought in Richie Larea, who's been excellent for Toronto FC second half of this year, but he's been excellent going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Not much of a defender still. They have a question. That's three spots where they have a question on the back line. They also have a question at left back. I mean, Sam Adekugbe has been pretty good. Kamal Miller has played there at times for Orlando City.
And played there, I think, against Cuba at home.
Right, which was a 6-0 win for Canada. Also, you know, some potential there. Marc-Anthony Kaye has played there.
Stop.
Played there in the past. And that's a big question because they have a bunch of talented central midfielders. You know Sam Piet's going to start.
Do you know that?
In this type of game, you have to.
Because it's the U.S. at home.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sam Piet's going to start. Scott Arfield's going to start.
You have Jonathan Osorio and Marc-Anthony Kaye probably fighting for that other
spot. It hurts your soul to put Marc-Anthony Kaye at left back, but you would rather leave the backup at left back on the bench than Jonathan Osorio or Scott Arfield. I totally understand why anybody detests a Marc-Anthony Kaye or Alphonso Davies option at left back, but if you're a coach, it comes down to marginal gains, and who do you want to leave off that team sheet? Right now, you would rather leave the backup left back than whoever your fourth center midfielder is.
It kills my soul to hear that because you said off the top, Canada won't have possession. Is there not a world in which you put Osorio and Kaye out there with Piet behind them and they could control a midfield against this U.S. team right now?
I think there is, but I don't think that's John Herdman's wheelhouse.
That's not his game plan. Okay, yeah. That's fair. So then the rest of the question and one name to throw in on the back line, Juan Cordova, mm-hmm. who has never played for Canada, Portuguese, Canadian, playing in Mexico. He got called up for this one.
Isn't he playing in Chile?
Playing in Chile, yeah, sorry. Yeah. He's an option at right back, potentially, or maybe swapped over to left back, but right now Canada out there
looking
for defenders.
He's got two caps, by the way. He has played for Canada.
Yes.
Yeah.
Up top, you've got Alphonso Davies, you got Junior Hoylett, you got Lucas Cavallini, you've got Jonathan David.
Yeah.
Who wants to go first on this one? What would you do against the U.S.?
Go as fast as possible.
Yeah.
Right? Just maximize your ability to hit them in transition. The U.S., while they've taken steps forward, have not been perfect in possession. Is that a fair way to put it?
Oh, yeah.
And when you have Alphonso Davies, when you have a Jonathan David, Junior Hoylett, maybe to a little bit of a lesser extent, just go out on the break. I mean, I'm not 100% convinced on that, but that's the way I would go with it.
I'm going to read you this from John Herdman, the Canadian head coach. From an attacking perspective, the only team that really caused them trouble against Uruguay, they dominated the number of passes, dominated the possession, dominated the chances, is the Mexicans. The Mexicans have a very deliberate style and an intensity in how they just won't let Berhalter's machine settle into a rhythm. That's how I've seen the U.S. develop. They're like a well-oiled machine. Everything works off a trigger, off a cue, and if you're able to disrupt that rhythm, then the team struggles. He then went on to talk about pressing them.
Yep.
Like, maybe Canada, from what he's saying, maybe Canada comes out and presses them. I think if that happens, it gets ugly really, really quick.
You wouldn't press the U.S.?
Not if I'm Canada. If I'm Mexico, I absolutely do.
Because you don't trust their back line to handle things when the U.S. breaks the press?
Correct.
You think he was talking about pressing them high?
Yeah.
And it seemed like going into the Cuba game, he mentioned a couple times some of the things we're working on are looking forward to the USA game, and it was Jonathan David at center forward pressing high and them creating chances. They did it in the Gold Cup, but it was against teams like Martinique and Cuba, not against teams like the U.S. and Mexico. And
I mean, they did create a goal off of Jonathan David one-man press versus Mexico in the Gold Cup. I don't think I would be comfortable with that if I was if I'm leaving all that space in behind, and it's Jordan Morris on one side and Christian Pulisic on the other, or maybe Christian Pulisic bursting out of central midfield and, I don't know, Paul Areola on the other side, you're just asking to get counterattacked. And like, if you're going to get out possessed and you're going to get countered to death, then you're not leaving yourself much of a margin for a win. Whereas if you look at the U.S., like whether it's Michael Bradley or Jackson Yule, both very, very good players, excellent passers of the ball, very calm under pressure, not running anybody down in transition. If you look at the U.S., right fullback goes way high up the field. Left fullback goes pretty high as well. Suddenly you have two center backs who are got to put out all the fires, and it's going to be Matt Miazga and Tim Ream, neither of whom are the best in those 1v1 situations at pace in the open field. So I just think that, like, you say, go ahead, have 65% of the ball. It's one pass, blind switch to the, you know, we're going to leave a winger high, blind switch to that winger, go.
It's going to be fun to watch Alphonso Davies and Jonathan David get out on the break in this game. It's a huge game for Canada. We mentioned it for a lot of reasons. One, to try and win their group in Ligue A. Another, to try and get into the hex. It seems there are about five teams who, based on the FIFA rankings, which it'll be decided next June, the top six teams in CONCACAF in the FIFA rankings will be put directly into the X. It seems like five teams are about established. Jamaica, the fifth of them, still perfect in League B action, but some question marks on spot six. And right now, Curaçao doing a little bit of work to try and get to that spot. They beat Haiti in the last set of games. They came out here and they got a draw at Costa Rica. Costa Rica back-to-back draws to open their Ligue A play. And
how many times? How many times over the years would you have killed to see the U.S. get a draw in Costa Rica in World Cup qualifying? Like, if you look at what Curaçao's done over the past 4 months, they beat Honduras in the U.S. in the Gold Cup. And we remember that U.S. Curaçao game. U.S. got the goal. Curaçao controlled the play. And like, Berhalter came on this show and did a pretty excellent interview about that a month and a half ago, talking about, we were just too arrogant against Curaçao. We got that goal and we thought they were going to lay down and die. They didn't. They played right through us. And then going out, and by the way, they went out without Cuco Martina, who is their captain and probably their best player. They went to Costa Rica and got a point. That's amazing. Yeah. That is really, really, really well done from this team. They play stylish soccer. And Eloy Room, goalkeeper for Columbus Crew, massive when he needs to be, is looking like one of the best goalkeepers in in CONCACAF right now.
And for Costa Rica, on the flip side, I mentioned two draws, one at Haiti. Gonzalez Brenes is going to take over as coach after this window, but a couple question marks from their fan base going into World Cup qualifying. Mexico walked all over Bermuda with a 5-1 win.
We got to shout out our guy Paul on Twitter, who wanted us to let everyone know that Roy Lassiter's kid, Ariel Lassiter, played for Costa Rica in that draw against Curaçao the other day.
Yeah. In League B action, speaking of MLS legends, Charlie Joseph has led Granada to already clinch their group, which means they'll go into a Gold Cup qualifier, which is pretty impressive. And as I said, Jamaica remains perfect. Dominican Republic won again, so they're tied with El Salvador on top of their group. In MLS international action, Brian Rodriguez, the Cobra, Kaku, and Shemyshaw Frankowski all scored in international games. Cobra did it against England in a 2-1 win for Czech Republic. Kaku, it seems like, is getting the most air miles anyone has ever gotten playing for the Paraguayan national team. Respect to that. I enjoy the hustle there, Kaku. And on that note, let's look domestic. Let's start with some playoff previews. We've, of course, got the MLS playoffs coming up this week on October 19th and 20th. But first, let's talk about the NWSL playoffs. The semifinals will be on October 20th. Back-to-back games on ESPN2, North Carolina hosting the Seattle Reign at 1:30 p.m. Eastern time. And then that one followed up, the Chicago hosting Portland Thorns at 3:30 p.m. Eastern time, of course, on ESPN2 as well. And then the final will be October 27th. That one will be in Cary, North Carolina, no matter who wins. And to do that, we're going to talk to a U.S. Women's National Team legend, Kelly O'Hara, for our AT&T Call to the Field. Kelly, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So, Kel, you've been out for parts of the year, and the Royals, unfortunately, didn't make the playoffs. So you are the perfect neutral observer heading in. Let's start with the North Carolina Courage versus Seattle Reign. Give us the overview of how these teams got here and who they are.
Well, North Carolina obviously has the track record that they do, which is they win the Shield and they always contest for the championship. So that's how they're there. We're going into this semifinal. And Seattle has had an interesting year in that, we were kind of fighting it out with them to the very end as to who was going to get that last playoff spot. And they pulled ahead, and props to them for doing that. They had a couple people out for World Cup, and they've had a lot of injuries. So I think it's pretty great for them and impressive that they have been able to get into that last playoff spot.
And who are the star players, or maybe not star players, but the players to watch for each team going into this matchup?
Let me think. I mean, obviously, Pino at Seattle, she can turn on at any point and is always a threat. And for North Carolina, they just have such a potent attack. They have so many players that it's hard to narrow down to one or two that are just, they just are a high octane offense team. They score a ton of goals and are relentless on the attack whenever you play them. So I would say their whole attack.
That's a lot to contend with. The second game, doubleheader on Sunday on ESPN2. Chicago Red Stars hosting the Portland Thorns. Give us the breakdown, the overview of those two squads.
Yeah, Chicago and Portland. Apparently Chicago has never won a semifinal. They've never made it into the finals. I didn't know that, but I'm actually doing another podcast on the playoffs, so somebody brought that up with me, which I think is interesting. And then Portland, they've won the championship, and so I think experience comes into play there. I think Portland has won at all of their matches this year against Chicago. I'm not positive on that, but it'll be interesting. I mean, Portland will be playing on the road, correct, against Chicago. And I think that is a big factor in maybe how the game will go.
Who are the names that you're looking at in this series? Obviously, Sam Kerr, one that's going to come out for people that haven't followed them maybe all year. Who are the keys star players for this matchup?
Yeah, I mean, Sam Kerr is obviously one of the best players in the whole world, and one of the most exciting to watch and just extremely lethal in the final third. And then for Chicago, I think you have Alyssa in goal, which is huge for them. And then JJ is just such a dominant player and is really just like a gamer and I think really leads that team on the field. And then with Portland, you got Tobin, you got Lindsay, you got Sonnet, you got AD, you got a lot of players. You have Sinclair. I mean, they're just a loaded team as well. Midge Purse has been having a huge year for them too. So it's going to be a battle. I mean, all these teams are stacked in the semifinals. So it's hard to narrow down to one or two players.
Yeah, it's interesting about the league, the fact that there's not that many teams. So every team has nothing but international stars. Okay, let's go back to North Carolina hosting Seattle. Who is the favorite going into that one, and what might be the difference maker between two very talented teams?
I think the favorite is North Carolina, just because they have that experience. They know what it takes to win the Shield, which is consistency throughout the season, and then to win a championship, and that's turning up in big games with a lot of pressure, because they've done it. Their track record shows that. And they're playing at home, and that's huge too. You know, Seattle has to travel across country and play in their stadium. So I think North Carolina, I would put money on them. Not that I am. I wouldn't do that. I think that's illegal. But yeah, I would say North Carolina.
And what about the other one? About the Red Stars hosting the Thorns? Who's the favorite in that?
Ooh, I think it's going to go to PKs, actually. And that will be exciting because you have AD on one side and you have Alyssa Mayer on another. And that will just, that's going to be a nail biter, I feel like. And maybe it won't be, but I could, then someone, I think me saying that is someone's going to blow the other team out. But I think it's going to come down to PKs.
Well, we hope that it is a phenomenal day of semifinals games and everything, of course, leading up to the final on October 27th, 3:30 p.m. Eastern time on ESPN. That'll be in Cary, North Carolina, whether the North Carolina Courage win their semifinal or not. But, of course, their fans are hoping that they get to see a home team win a championship this year. Kelly O'Hara, we hope that you are healthy and ready to go again in 2020. But if not, you're always welcome to come on this podcast, maybe even before you go on other podcasts, and we could be your number one.
Sounds good, guys. Thank you.
Thank you so much again to Kelly O'Hara for taking the time to join us, the best soccer player in Stanford history, male or female. That's on you. It's unarguable because she has won multiple World Cups, so it wasn't even controversial what I just said. But figured I had a chance to get in Bobby's face. I was in the Bay Area, and I was like, I can't believe anyone would let Bobby live in this area.
It's too nice for him.
Yeah, it is for very sure. Much so.
Sitting right here.
University of San Francisco, by the way, looks like they have a cool soccer setup.
They do. Yeah. They have multiple championships. They had the most championships until a few years ago.
Yeah. So that'd be a cool
John
place.
John Doyle.
That'd be a cool place to play.
Yeah, Steven Negoesco was the legendary head coach there. Yeah.
We are off to a fly start to our 2019 Audi MLS Cup playoff preview. We are finished with NWSL. We move to Major League Soccer. It starts on Saturday. It rolls through to Sunday. Four games on Saturday, two games on Sunday. And we've got a nice full week to preview this. So today, we will do the Eastern Conference opening round games. On Thursday, we will do the Western Conference. And then we will do a little bit more about awards and, you know, the format of the playoffs going forward and predictions all the way through to MLS Cup or whatever it is Andrew Wiebe chooses to do when he returns. But that's what Dave's planning. Let's start with Atlanta United against the New England Revolution, the first game of the playoffs opening up in 2019. I am going to pose a question to both of these gentlemen. Each will answer for one team to start on all the playoff series, and then we will move on from there. So to start this out, Atlanta United will win this series, Matt Doyle, if they do X.
Play up to their talent level. I think if you look at these two teams, the one has Joseph and PT and Barco and Nagby and Gressel and hopefully a healthy Miles Robinson and Leandro Gonzalez-Pires. And we've seen Brad Guzan, and we've seen what this team can do in the playoffs. We saw this, what this team could do against Club America. We saw what this team could do against the U.S. Open Cup. They're at home. They're against a worse team. They just have to be themselves.
What are the chances of that happening? I mean, in any given, you're exactly right. If this Atlanta team plays the potential and balls out, they might be the best team in the league. They're certainly maybe the most fun team to watch in the league. What are the probabilities that you would take in a hard game on that happening? Because if you go back through their last 3 months, except for that stretch when they won Campeones Cup and Open Cup and I believe beat NYCFC,
mm-hmm.
there haven't been many of those games this year. So what is the probability that that happens?
I mean, they had that great August.
Yeah, but that's it. But and Atlanta fans don't like to hear this, but that is it for this team. They won a lot of games. They got a lot of shutouts. If you're talking about truly open play to their talent level performances, other than that four, I think six-game win streak in all competitions, that's
it. But that's the thing. They don't need to play like that to beat most teams because they just have such an inherent talent advantage. Joseph is the second best player in the league. And then behind him, they have potentially $30 million worth of Argentinian attacking midfielders. And like, to be clear, I still don't rate Barco. And I think PT has been, by most measures, kind of a disappointment in this first year. But they've won two trophies anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They just have to keep doing what they've been doing. And I will add, New England setup, they allow you to complete passes and to get on the ball through central midfield. And in that 3-4-2-1, if you can have, you know, PT on one side or Hindman and Barco or Hindman on the other side sort of coming in and just naturally getting on the ball in the half spaces, they can and will cause problems for the refs.
Coach, he took part of my...
Okay, well...
You're the one who didn't want to prepare, Bobby. You wanted this to be off the cuff.
I'm fully prepared. Bobby, I just think you should be able to follow rules.
Bobby, you're the one who asked the follow-up question.
Fair. Okay.
Bobby Warshaw, the New England Revolution, will win this playoff matchup against Atlanta United on Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern time on Univision and TDN if they do X.
If they finish their chances, especially their early ones. It comes down to that. We saw the two teams play at Mercedes-Benz Stadium before.
A week ago.
Yes, Atlanta won. New England got plenty of chances, maybe even more chances, especially early. If Christian Pena doesn't trip over the ball into Brad Guzan in the first minute, they're up 1-0. But for me, that was the story of the game. They got their opportunities because Atlanta are a street soccer team. They are not a team that is buttoned up. They are a team that goes end-to-end and is fine with that because they are more than likely going to create better chances in an end-to-end game and finish more chances. But this game will be relatively even if New England takes their chances.
Did you feel that Atlanta were a street soccer end-to-end team back in August when they were playing well?
Roughly, yeah. They were just at their potential of it.
And so it's a complete 180 from the first 4 months of the season when they were anything but that.
Yes. And the hack to all of this is playing three center backs. I mean, the hack to not really having cohesive tactics or a offensive marking plan or a possession plan that stops you from giving away counterattacks is three center backs and having a player like Miles Robinson. That's it. You don't need, if you keep three or four players behind the ball, two of which are very fast, it makes your life easier.
The problem is they might not have a player like Miles Robinson. He withdrew from the U.S. national team camp with an injury. Of course, Joseph Martinez injured before decision day presented by AT&T, but fortunately, he is okay, we think. You mentioned Barco, PT, Emerson Hyman. There are question marks in this lineup for Frank de Boer. What do you expect to see?
I don't know. people have been raving about Barco. He's played 2,700 MLS minutes. He has 8 goals and 6 assists. Santiago Mosquera has played 2,700 minutes. He has 9 goals and 7 assists. Like, we're not talking about a write-him-in-pen starter here. I don't know if he moves the needle that much. And then if you look back to August, he was starting those games for the most part. Hyndman has been pretty good. He's not productive. He doesn't put up a lot of box score numbers. I don't know if they need that. Maybe they just need solidity and, you know, just repeatedly being in the right spot. PT's a wild card. And we've seen it all year. PT can go entire months without showing up, and then he'll have a moment, and that's his MO coming from River Plate. He was never the best player in the Argentinian league. He was almost always the best player in the Copa Libertadores.
Yeah.
I don't know what to expect from that. I do know what to expect from Joseph, though. If you have Joseph leading the line in front of you, makes it a lot easier for everybody. And I'll also say, I mean, Julian Gressel's getting to that point as well, where it's like, if you have him at right wing back, you know you're getting productivity from right wing back. So you have those two. You have Nagby, who's, I mean, if he plays like he did against Club America, then you just waltz him right into MLS Cup again.
It feels like we're underselling what's happening here, and I'm surprised Doyle's doing it as an OG.
Yeah,
when he saw
say.
The original state or where Major League Soccer came from in 1996. We're talking about Atlanta United. We have not mentioned this single line enough, and whoever writes the next definitive history of Major League Soccer needs to make a chapter titled
When the Dream Becomes a Reality. Could be.
When author. Talking about the time in 2018 when Atlanta United won MLS Cup with the most expensive player, $15 million in league history on the bench. They could do it again. If you're going to put out a lineup right now, it almost certainly doesn't include PT Martinez. Maybe something changes in the next week, but...
Why are you so certain about that?
The entire season, recent form, general Frank DeBoer disposition and preferences. I would put a decent chunk on the fact that PT is the odd one out.
Okay, so that's a big question mark. We know that.
I just want to say, recent form, since the middle of September, 6 games. He started 5 of them. He has 2 goals, 2 assists, which is his most productive stretch of the season.
He also did not play at all in the last game of the season.
Yeah, I mean, coming off a stretch where he played 5 games, including 4 90-minute performances. No, I'm sorry, those weren't 4 90-minute performances. Nonetheless, 5 games in the span of 15 days. Yeah. Maybe it was just like, he's burnt. We have to give him a little
bit of rest.
The fact
that it's even a conversation.
I agree with that.
Still mind-boggling.
I agree with that. And I remember when this signing was rumored last year, my mentions were filled up with people guaranteeing he would be the best player in MLS history.
This guy right here. Sure of it. Let me ask you one last one. The Miles Robinson health issue. What is the percentage? What's the difference for Atlanta United with him on the field and without him on the field?
I don't know if they can play the way they play without Miles Robinson, because Escobar is fast, but you're not going to put him in the middle of that back five, back three, whatever you want to call it. Michael Parkhurst can't really do that anymore, I don't think.
So you think it'd be Gonzalez Pires at that spot?
But can't you,
if you were to play a different style.
I wouldn't
style,
want to, I'm just asking.
If you were to play a different style. I mean, Michael Parkhurst was a finalist for Defender of the Year last year, right? Mm-hmm. This is a guy that can still play at a high level. It's depressing and sad that he's retiring. If you were to play a different style, I know that people love Miles Robinson. I personally think that's a little too far for where he's at right now, but in this specific style, with the way they play, it is Aaron Long and Red Bulls-esque. It is Ike Opara for – it's just the perfect guy for the way they are playing right now. So, yes, it's hard to believe this team can be as effective without the right guy for the right moment in that system.
1 p.m. Eastern time on Saturday on Univision on 2DN, the Audi 2019 MLS Cup playoffs begin. Will Atlanta United be heading for what would be a return to a final, or – will the Revs somehow shock us all? And that would sort of not shock us all, because the Revs are a very odd team. I'm not going to let you talk about it, though, because we're moving on to the next one. Toronto, DC United on 2DN, TSN4, and Tevia 2 at 6 p.m. Eastern time on Saturday. TFC hosting DC United because they couldn't beat a 9-man FC Cincinnati at home. Matt Doyle, Toronto FC will win this if they do X.
Score a goal. I mean, DC United could not score against 9-man FC Cincinnati at home. I believe they were shut out in the game before that as well. They're one of the lowest scoring teams in the playoffs. They haven't had any semblance of consistent offense, consistent attack, basically since April. They're a really tough team to break down. They're really tough defensively. But if Toronto get out on the front foot and they have Josie healthy and they play like they have in the second half of the season, they will score a goal or two. And if it's one, I'm pretty confident they'll get through. If it's two, then it's 98% they're going through, because DC just, unless they're just waiting for the playoffs to flip the switch, which is possible. We've seen teams do that before in the playoffs. But DC hasn't looked like beating anybody.
Can Toronto do that without
Send it
Josie.
Over, David. Send it over,
oh,
David.
You want your question now?
When you answer, have David answer, but...
Can Toronto do that without Josie, though?
No. If Josie's not healthy for this, Toronto are going to lose.
All right.
Send it over, David.
Bobby, DC United will win this series if they do X.
They have Paul Areola stifle Michael Bradley in the middle of the field. Similar to what Tyler Adams did 2 years ago, where if you stop Michael Bradley on this Toronto team and you can disrupt what they do and you give yourself opportunities for transition, you are in a very good position against this Toronto FC team. Because Michael Bradley, for his ups and downs, is still the main player in that team. When he plays well, the team plays well. I'm not sure he has it in his legs, and I'm a little bummed to say this, maybe even in his energy levels, to get away from a Paul Areola chasing him around, because that's the way they've been playing, the 4-4-2, 4-4-1-1, with Areola be off behind the striker. And if they adjust that from a 4-4-2 mid-block shape to have Areola follow Bradley.
Do you have Areola man-mark Bradley? Like, just break your own shape. Because it's not like DC have a shape. It's not like they have any, you know.
It's not a complex shape. It's a shape, but there's not a ton of.
They have five straight shutouts.
That's, yeah.
Shapeless
because
shutouts.
They have, like, they have nine field players who run themselves into the ground defending. And then their one creative guy, Wayne Rooney, it's like he's a workhorse too. So, like, they're really tough to break down. They're really tough to score against. What I'm saying is, like, usually if you're man marking someone, you're sacrificing something in terms of your attack just because you don't know where the guy is going to be, makes it tough to build quickly, make it tough to build through him. But with DC, you're kind of sacrificing that already. So why not have Areola just sit on Michael Bradley this entire game?
Yeah, I think that's what I was alluding to. That's what they're going to do. I mean, there's a small difference between having him block out lanes and follow Bradley. Whatever they choose, I think it gets to the same end. Yeah, I would probably go as far as to man mark him. I'm okay with that.
It could be short-lived. Wayne Rooney's time in Major League Soccer started a little over a year ago. This could be his last game in MLS, which kind of comes out of nowhere. He was suspended for the final game of the regular season. Now he's back for the Audi 2019 MLS Cup playoffs. But it could happen fast. Like, all of a sudden, he was here, and he's gone.
At
the same time, he's the one guy you probably want for DC where you say, you know, it's a bunch of defensive players, everyone working hard, and then he'll create a moment for us. And that could be what it is in this series. That one, 6 p.m. Eastern time on Saturday, 2DN in the U.S., TSN 4 and TVA 2 in Canada. I'll be at that game, so if you're hanging out in Toronto, feel free to say what up. My city, I feel home once again. And then on Sunday,
I thought you were more of a Montreal guy.
I like many cities.
Okay. Okay.
But I only rep them when I'm going there so that everyone will like when I get there. So watch out, Doyle. Get out of my
lane.
Don't
wear blue.
I've never owned a blue shirt in my entire life or blue clothing of any sort.
Clearly.
On Sunday, the Eastern Conference first round will close up at 3 p.m. on FS1. The Philadelphia Union will host the New York Red Bulls, still looking for Philadelphia for their first ever postseason win. Bobby Warshaw. Mm-hmm. It will come if they do X.
Wait, which team am I doing real quick?
Philadelphia.
Okay, that's a great decision. I was worried you're going to give me Red Bulls, and it was good content to make Doyle talk about the Red Bulls right now.
Okay.
That was a good decision. I'm looking at your note here. I just want to say, in the note, it was very poor grammar that you used. It makes no sense.
Yeah.
Nobody can actually see that. But
okay, yeah. I'm telling you. You can't see it from through your earphones, but it's very bad grammar. We'll get to that later. You want to get to that later, though?
Oh, my goodness.
Philadelphia will win if they come into the game not trying to be a possession team. If they come to the game with a singular agenda that they will beat Red Bulls at the Red Bulls game. Because that was their idea coming in. We are going to implement the Ernst Tanner, German, Leipzig, whatever you want to call it, pressing system. They started the 4-4-2 diamond. And this team is at their best when they do the pressing and winning balls and the Red Bulls version of themselves more than when they try and be the Philadelphia Union version of themselves, which for me is possession first. They need to be a pressing team that can pass, not a passing team that works pretty hard.
On the flip side, Matt Doyle, the New York Red Bulls will win this series, this matchup, if they do X.
If Philly doesn't do what Bobby just said. Like, but I really think New York's only chance here is to run Philly over. Just bully them all over the field. And if the Red Bulls don't do that, then they're in real trouble right from the bat. And we've seen this throughout the year. The Red Bulls have these 20, 30, 40-minute stretches where they can press and look like that monster of a team that 71 points last year and, you know, what they did in like, they still can look like that, but they don't do it for the full game. Now, Maybe that had to do with weather. Maybe it just had to do with a natural hangover year over year. I mean, we all remember that. I don't know if we do all remember, but like, it's not like Jesse Marsh's Red Bulls teams were getting 65, 70 points every regular season. They had some down years and then started playing better at the end of the season. Maybe that's what we're going to see here for the Red Bulls. If that is going to happen, it's going to start with their energy levels and just looking more committed to winning every 40-60, not just 50-50s, for the full 90 minutes. And then one of their young forwards is going to have to be the guy. Brian White is just coming back. Tom Barlow's had some good moments and bad moments. There's no Bradley Wright Phillips anymore. And then on top of that, they're going to need to find an answer to the question that has plagued them for the last 6 years, which is who's the secondary goal scorer. There's a lot.
2 points coming off of that. Do you know how many points the New York Red Bulls had in 2017 with Jesse Marsh as their manager?
It was like 50, 51.
It was 50. It was two more points than they got this year. Just context of these things, right?
But all they also lost in the first round of the playoffs.
Right. All the angst about where Red Bulls are right now, what Chris Armas has done, they are only 2 points behind Jesse Marsh, I think 2 or 3 years into his reign. Just putting that out there for perspective, you have to feel like this is the best possible matchup for the Red Bulls, isn't it? To play the Philadelphia Union, to play on the road at Philly, this has to be Chris Armas's dream. My only other add here is, for me, this is the matchup with the most tension, with the most pressure all around. Philadelphia has so much anxiety about getting over that hump. Three playoff appearances in 4 years.
They've never won a game.
Never won a game. Three U.S. Open Cup finals. On the verge of really becoming a team or a club that can develop and produce and ideally sell high-quality domestic talent. They are on the bubble of so many elements, but really not through any of them, right? And you can feel that tension. Maybe you can't feel it. I can feel it. In my own narrative, in my brain, it feels like there's real tension. And Red Bull is on the other side. This has been the most anxiety-filled year that I can remember since they started not being bad, which is, what, 2012, 2013?
Yeah.
So anyway, it feels like the moat with the most on the line for both clubs. We're not going to give JCO any credit for 08 or what?
Well, let's just say 96 and start there. One of the things I find interesting is I think the playoff format has been defined by no club more than the New York Red Bulls over the last 5 years of just dominating in the in the regular season, but struggling in the postseason. Now it's a total flip side for them. They're going to go on the road. They could potentially not host a single game in the playoffs, but they could still make a run. Maybe being a little bit more comfortable going to an MLS Cup final will be interesting to see. As I said, that one on Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern time on FS1. That'll do it for the Eastern Conference so far, but we've still got the Western Conference coming up and plenty more to talk about with this new playoff format, with our predictions, what we think's going to happen. But first, before we do that, on Thursday, let's talk a little award season, because everyone's ballots had to go in last week. We are slowly going to learn about finalists and winners over the next week or so. And let's start out with a few that are going to come out first. And maybe you guys disagree on, I don't know, AT&T Rookie of the Year. That's going to be the first one we discuss. We're going to mention Newcomer of the Year as well as the Siggy Schmidt Coach of the Year. AT&T Rookie of the Year. Who did you vote for?
Andre Shinashiki. I just thought that his ability as a two-way player, I think he had 7 goals, 3 assists, playing some center forward, some second forward on both wings, did it in about 1,700 minutes, was a key part of Colorado becoming really good the final two-thirds of the season. And I think what separated him from me was two things. First of all, his consistency, just game to game. He was really, really good. And second of all, he's just a devastating defensive player. Devastating defensive player. So you add that good attacking production, consistency, and like high-level defensive contribution from a winger. I don't want to say it wasn't an easy call. I think there's a good argument for Gasper and especially Hassani Dotson in Minnesota. But I thought Shinashiki was just a little bit better.
So just to put the math together, you're putting the guy with 27 starts for the 5th best team in Major League Soccer in the middle of the field, in a really a more difficult position on the field than Shinashiki, Dotson, or Gasper. 4th on your Rookie of the Year voting? 27 starts for the 5th best team.
We're talking about Brendan Aaronson. Yeah, I had Aaronson 4th. Because I think for most of those starts, he was sub-replacement level player. I thought the last 7-8 games, he got benched, I want to say, in August. And he came back from that a better player. But even now, he's not a 90-minute player. I think I think Aaronson and Tati Castellanos, who's not rookie of the year, but I'm just thinking about young players, they're perfect examples of why you play your kids. Why you say, okay, I'm going to deal with 20 games of subpar performance if I believe in this kid's talent and his work ethic. Because at the end of it, you come up with someone who can be a real difference maker. But like we've all talked about the effect Ilsenio has had on this Philadelphia Union team, how they're plus 27 or something like that with him on the field, which means minus 18 with him off the field. Usually he was coming on for Brendan Aaronson. Now, I think Brendan Aaronson is going to have a really, really good career. I think that if you were to force me to pick between Aaronson, Dotson, Gasper, and Shinashiki, I think that Aaronson probably has the highest upside of all of them, but I don't think he was the best player. I think he was the fourth best player of that group.
Talk about styles of rhetoric to take Ilsenio and throw it back in Bobby's face. That is a masterclass.
Wait, who did you have, Bobby?
I Brendan Aaronson. Listen, what you said isn't wrong. This is not something I feel passionate about, but Aaronson was on the better team, man. He held down a spot. Was he an absolutely better player than Dotson or Shinashiki in their minutes? Definitely arguable, but I'm willing to reward someone for having a consistent role in a good team with fluctuating systems and a fluctuating spot.
There's no N in that word.
Yeah.
There's no fluctuating?
Fluctuating.
Yeah. Are you sure?
Yeah.
In a fluctuating system and a fluctuating spot, I'm willing to give bonus points for that.
Moving on because of the fluctuation of that situation. let's move to newcomer of the year, Bobby. Who did you vote for and why was it Christian Pavone?
It was not Christian Pavone.
Oh, what? You didn't pick the guy who's played 12 games?
It was not
it's
Christian
weird that
Pavone.
The Athletic was pushing for him. It was really strange.
Little Athletic plug right there. Who did you vote for?
I have Carlos Hill. Double digit. I'm going to pull up the exact numbers, but double digit goals and assists. But more importantly, just was the cornerstone for the resurrection of a club. And yes, Gustavo Bow came back, but Hill was there when they really started to turn under Mike Lapper. Hill was the one that got the armband. Hill was the one whose performance has changed it. And I always say on this podcast that if you can do something beyond the stat sheet, if you can offer a little something to an organization on the field, off the field, that gets you extra points.
On the field, 10 goals, 14 assists.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So double in both, which as a total goals assist combo beats Eber in the category, who really seems to be the clear number two. So both for his absolute contribution on the field, but what he meant to that club and everything else, Hill is my newcomer of the year.
Doyle, how do you feel about that?
I think there's a good argument for Hill. I had him third. I had Eber as number one because you could divide NYCFC season into two parts. It was before Eber and after Eber.
PH and PH.
Yeah. So I think he was pretty clearly number one, but I understand the argument for Hill. I had Segura second. He's the best defender on the best defense in the league. And that is a pretty strong argument. In fact, it's pretty close to Bobby's argument about...
Also, I would throw out while Walker Zimmerman was at Gold Cup.
Yes.
So
I just want to push back on the best defender and the best... Because one thing that worries me that we do in these awards, and we could talk about the defender of the year. It feels relevant to what Matt just said. Mm-hmm. For the first 20 games of the year, Walker Zimmerman was undoubtedly the best defender in Major League Soccer. He was the best defender on the best team. His own personal performances were excellent. He slipped. But if you were to take the aggregate of all his performances, he's not that far behind.
It wasn't 20. It was about 12 or 15 games. It was before the Gold Cup. He hasn't been the same player since coming back from the Gold
Cup. When did they leave for the Gold Cup?
Beginning of June, I believe. So that would
this
be...
This is about to be fantastic. 50,
game right? number 15.
Okay. So 15. That's a worthwhile distinction from 20. But half the season, he was the best defender. Mm-hmm. So I just want to keep that in mind. Did he slip? Yes. To say that Eddie Segura was the best defender in LAFC throughout the year...
But part of what you like have to say with LAFC is what changed for Walker Zimmerman from last year to this year. Other players changed. He was there a year longer, but one of them was Eddie Segura.
For sure.
Being
He's been very good.
Alongside him. On that note, the Ziggy Schmidt coach of the year, everyone voted for Bob Bradley because
be
no
unanimous.
One's trying to be too much and be too extra and vote for, I don't know, whatever. No offense, Jim Curtin or Matias Almeida or Bruce Arena or Adrian Heath, whoever else you want to vote for. The points record, Carlos Vela breaking the record, everything else, plus just a bomber jacket that no one else could really pull off in Major League Soccer. And on that note, it's been a pleasure, guys. Thanks for joining me for this one. Bobby, I thought you did such a good job last week hosting the show by yourself.
What was your favorite part, David?
My favorite part was the part where you came on and you said extra time. That was my favorite part. Did you ever do that?
Yeah.
Unsure. Cool. Nailed it. All right. On that note, thanks so much for joining us. Andrew Reed will be back on Thursday. Send us your mailbag questions for all playoffs, not just Western Conference. Who do you think going to win? What are the factors that you're looking forward to? What are the matchups you're most excited? I think that's one of the best parts about this setup right now is we've got some really juicy matchups going forward. For Matt Doyle, Bobby Warshaw, and myself, David Goss, thanks so much for watching. We'll be right back.